Okay, so today I'm here with Claire Robertson. Claire Robertson is a physiotherapist from the UK and she specialises in the patellofemoral joint. So hello, Claire.
Hello.
So thank you, Claire, for coming on today to have a chat with us. I'm looking forward to finding out more about the patellofemoral joint, all the new research and techniques and things that we should know and should be doing. But first of all, perhaps you could just give us a little introduction for the people that don't know who you are or who've never met you.
Sure, okay. Well, I'm a consultant physiotherapist at Wimbledon Clinics, and that is purely in patellofemoral pain. I'm a physio by trade. I've been a physio for 20 years, and I now split my time between my clinical posts, my research, which is all on the patellofemoral joint, and my teaching, which Kells the Breeze is also on the patellofemoral joint. So immersed in patellofemoral.
Excellent. And so how long have you been immersed in the patellofemoral joint?
Well, purely patellofemoral pain for 7 years. So it's quite a few patellofemoral joints.
Yeah, it is.
But I'm moving towards it with my research and my clinical practice for probably 10 to 12 years.
Okay, and what made you want to specialise in the patellofemoral joint, if I can ask that question?
Sure, well, I guess it started off where I was sort of doing the typical physio route, going down the MSK route, and then I became really sort of lower limb specialist, which isn't that unusual. And then really it was when I did my master's, I did my dissertation on the presence of patellofemoral pain after hip replacement, which was something I'd seen in clinical practice and interested me.
That sounds interesting.
And much to my, I was absolutely dreading my dissertation and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it. And I actually published that work. And that was the beginning of my research journey as well. And so I started to sort of get a name for as someone that had an interest in patellofemoral pain and carried on my research, which then I guess sort of fed the cycle of getting more of a name for myself in patellofemoral pain. And gradually I was seeing more and more patellofemoral pain. And then Wimbledon Clinics approached me and said, do you want to do a second opinion service? And so I said, yes. So it's absolutely fantastic because now I have this really homogenous patient group, which is also fantastic for my research.
Yes, of course.
And then, of course, with the hat of the research and the clinical, I feel in a good position to teach on the subject as well.
Yeah, and you've just started doing that recently, haven't you? Is that right?
Yeah, well, I had an academic post at St George's, University of London, until 2 years ago. As much as I enjoyed the academic environment, I felt it was quite generalist. So I would be lecturing on the shoulder, then on the knee and doing various things. And so I took the plunge and I actually left that job so that I could pursue the patellofemoral teaching. So I set my course up about 2 years ago, which is a day course aimed at postgraduate physios.
Yeah.
And I've been delivering that all over, really.
That's great.
Yeah, loving it.
Good. And so tell us a little bit about your research. I'm interested to hear about the research that, I'm interested to hear about the hip replacements and patellofemoral pain that you first started with. And then I'm interested to hear about the research that you are doing now, or that you've done and that you're doing now.
Sure. Well, every piece of research I've done has been driven by my clinical practice. So everything has been answering questions that I've seen in clinical practice and thought, why is that happening? And realised I couldn't find an answer in the literature.
That's taking evidence-based practice to the extreme.
Yeah, and I think hopefully it means that it's disseminated back into practice because
yes,
it's immediately meaningful to people, which is something I'm really passionate about.
Yeah.
So my very first piece of research was, as we've said, patellofemoral pain post-hip replacement. It was a fairly small study, but it was trying to take measures that clinicians can use, very easy measures, seeing was there any correlation between the measurements and who developed patellofemoral pain. And the main thing that correlated the most was distal thigh swelling. And interestingly, that was most prevalent in our younger patients who perhaps, I hypothesise, get up and going sooner, perhaps don't rest so much, don't elevate so much. and they get this swelling that descends and gets trapped under the distal ITB, and I think therefore alters the patellofemoral dynamic. So that was my starting point. I've written a couple of editorials, which one was having a little bit of a moan about the fact that I felt within the profession, patellofemoral pain is treated very much like a recipe. So people get a bit of a VMO, a bit of glutes, a few stretches, maybe an orthotic.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of saying, look, this is so prevalent as a patellofemoral pain, that is, that we really need to be a bit better than that and use our clinical reasoning skills. The other editorial I wrote was about crepitus, which was the beginning of my research journey with patellofemoral crepitus. So much to the amusement of some of my academic colleagues, I've spent some of my recent research time on noisy knees, as they call it.
Yeah.
And actually received a research grant from the physiotherapy, from the CSP, from their research group. And that has funded my research, doing qualitative research, interviewing patients about the meaning of crepitus to them and how it alters their behaviour. And I took people with a normal scan, so a structurally normal knee, and did in-depth open-ended interviews, which the first one or two, I have to say, I felt a bit ridiculous asking people about the noise in the knee, but I soon got cracking. And really, what I was suspicious of was correct, and that's that these patients demonstrate quite catastrophic beliefs. And really, it's quite similar to what we see in low back pain. It just happens that it's noise and not pain.
Yeah.
But they demonstrate very fear-avoidant behaviour. I mean, bearing in mind, as I say, these people have structurally normal knees, the ones that I interviewed. And they would say things like, well, it clearly means my knee is arthritic, or my knee is wearing away. I had one 26-year-old who was house hunting, and he said to me, I'm so perturbed by the noise from my knee, I've decided to only look at ground floor properties.
No.
That's pretty catastrophic.
That is catastrophic. That's amazing.
And I also asked patients, if a physio gave you an exercise and you went away and you did it and it wasn't painful, but it made your knee make your noise, what would you do? And every single patient said, I wouldn't do it. I thought, well, we need to know this as physios, because ultimately we're about normalising function. And, you know, if we address pain, strength, but the person still has the belief that I go up the stairs, my knee is noisy and I'm damaging it, they're still going to be avoidant of that unless we alter that health belief.
Yeah.
So that, it was very interesting. And the other area that was of great interest from this research that I'm hoping to pursue next year is the patients, to be honest, were quite slating about their experiences with health professionals, not just physios, health professionals across the board with respect to the symptom. And I remember one interview particularly sticks in my mind. The lady said to me, I feel really angry about it because everyone I have mentioned it to has been really dismissive. And I'm wondering, are they taking me seriously? Do they think that I'm a freak? Maybe they don't know what it means. And I could see the sort of anger coming out of her during our interview. And she said, this is more of a bother to me than my pain. She said, I hate it. She said, it makes me cringe.
Yeah.
And in fact, one patient said, it's like nails down a blackboard.
Yeah.
And in fact, I had a poster on this research at CSP conference recently, and I did the background to my poster was a big hand with nails on a blackboard to try and say, look, for some patients, this is a really big issue.
Yeah. It's interesting that people are mentioning that it's more of an issue than pain.
Well, that's where my starting point was, because obviously just seeing patellofemoral pain, I see a lot of patients.
Yeah.
And they often come in and they mention the crepitus before they mention the pain. And I thought, this is quite a big deal to these people.
Yeah, definitely.
And it was often reinforced by family members. You know, patients would say things like, oh, yeah, you know, I make sure that I don't go up the stairs and any of my family members around, because they all comment and go, ooh, your knee sounds horrid.
Oh, well, yeah, reinforcing something like that's not very good.
Yeah, I have one lady who said, I talk all the way around my run with my friends so that she can't hear my knee. I thought, well, you're doing quite well on the fitness level.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So it's been, It's been really insightful. It's changed my practice. So I now ask the basic question, what do you think it means if somebody mentions their crepitus?
Yeah. And can I ask you that question? What do you think it means?
Yeah, sure. Well, obviously I've looked at the literature extensively on this, which there isn't much literature, but what we seem to know is that it can be various things. It can be the classic bubbles of gas popping, like you can get in any joint. You get an isolated clunk sometimes, and patients often feel better after that, and that can be the patella locating into the trochlea, centrally.
Yeah.
Or the symptom that probably disturbs people the most is the fine grating type of noise that people get on the stairs.
Yeah.
And that is a phenomenon where we've taken a term from the engineering world called slip-stick phenomena, and that simply means description of noise arising as fluid passes through a slightly uneven surface.
Oh, okay. So say that again. Slip stiff.
Slip stick. Yeah.
Slip stick. Okay.
So, and the analogy I give to patients is if you put some fluid on a deep pile carpet and rubbed it, you'd get a sort of slightly like a friction noise.
Yeah.
That's really what's happening. And we would describe very minor retropatella fluffing up as a normal finding in the population.
Yeah.
So therefore we need to deem it that in those people it's a normal finding if you have this noise. There is another group which I do need to flag up, which is where they have more advanced chondral change, advanced degenerative change. And that is a different group. I'm looking really and interested in the patients who have essentially a normal structural, a normal knee, but who have beliefs that they've got advanced change in their knee.
Yeah, and I guess it's those patients that you can make the most difference with, because
absolutely,
as soon as you can educate them on what it is, what exactly is happening, and alleave their fears, then
that's right. And for some patients, you can see it's just like this huge weight off the shoulders. Oh, okay, and I say to people, look, there's a chance that this symptom was there before your pain, but the pain came along, and then we know from the literature there's more coming through on hypervigilance. People become hypervigilant to their pain and hence also then the noise in their knee.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think managing expectation is important too. So saying to people, look, I'm aiming to get rid of your pain because that is the abnormality. Your noise may remain, and we need to dissociate the two because the noise and the pain are not the same thing.
Yeah, okay. So if we're thinking about that the noise is coming from in these people with structurally sound knees in the normal, without the huge degenerative effects, that we're saying that, so the noise is completely separate from the pain. The pain isn't associated with the same presentation of the crepitus then?
No, so the pain can be from lots of different sources in patellofemoral pain. So the historical model is patella maltracking. And I really try and encourage people not to use that term, because I think if you use that term, it takes you down the route in your mind of thinking about patella position. And where we've really gone in the literature in the last 10 years or so, particularly with Christopher Power's work, is actually looking just as much at trochlear position. So in other words, looking at the femur relative to the patella.
Yeah.
So as much as it sounds nitpicky, I say to people, think about patellofemoral malalignment. So you're thinking about the whole thing. So it could be the patella, sure, but it may just as easily be the trochlea medializing, or of course it could be both. That then makes the presumption that pain is coming from the joint, and of course it isn't in all cases. So yes, it can be, and I think if it is, it's an overload of the subchondral bone.
Yes.
The bone under the cartilage, because as I say to people, remember the cartilage is aneural, it doesn't have any nerve endings. So it's either a pressure-related pain, so that's why it's often so mechanical. I put my knee in this position, or I do this and it hurts. I move position, or I stop doing the stairs and it's fine again.
So that's the subchondral pain?
That can be the subchondral pain.
And can that happen without cartilage defect?
Yes. So you can overload the subchondral bone, get excess pressure with a normal cartilage surface. And this is what I think we see a lot in our younger population.
And so why does that happen? Why in some people, why does the subchondral bone become painful.
Sure.
And in others, it doesn't.
Yeah, so it's biomechanical overload.
Okay.
So we know that at 60 degrees of knee flexion and 30 degrees of internal rotation of the femur, the lateral facet of the patella is hugely, is under huge pressure.
Yeah.
So if you go up the stairs and you travel through 60 degrees of knee flexion and your femur rolls in because of, for example, poor dynamic control,
yeah,
you will cause a scenario where you have excess pressure. And I say to patients, it's like a hot spot of pressure. So you get a sort of stiletto heel equivalent rather than a chunky heel. So you get one spot of really high pressure, and that can create pain.
Okay.
So,
we're talking subchondral pain in the patella or in the femur?
Or both? Either or both.
Okay. So it can be either.
It can absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, of course, that's in the structurally normal knee. You can get the same scenario in someone that has some change in their joint surfaces, and then you might enter the scenario where they've also got associated bone edema, where that excess pressure and that crack in the cartilage is driving fluid into the subchondral bone. Now, they tend to be more painful and harder to treat, and they take longer to treat because obviously there is bone edema that you need to reverse, as not just pure biomechanical change.
Absolutely, absolutely. So how can you address bone edema?
Well, we're trying to take the tack. If we take the pressure off that area through altered biomechanics or altered modification of activity or taping, bracing, then the idea is that you give that a bit of a window to calm down.
Yeah. Okay.
It's not really easy.
Yeah.
But so I would certainly be more cautious with my prognosis for someone with bone edema. But you know, it's still possible to get good results.
Okay. So it's not that they would require surgery to deal with the cartilage defect or anything. I guess that's a situation in some people, but perhaps not everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to be sort of handing patients over to the surgeons most quickly if they have symptoms such as acute locking, catching, where it's suggestive of a chondral flap. Then I would say, look, I'm unlikely to be able to alter that. Let's get a surgical opinion. And I'm lucky at the clinics. We work in a really multidisciplinary way, so we sort of have those sideways conversations all the time. But no, I wouldn't be rushing someone over to the surgeons just because of the presence of bone edema. No.
Yeah. No, I mean, I didn't want to bring up surgery really early in the conversation because that's not something that we should be immediately thinking about as physios. I guess that just led on to the thought about how we were coming into the people who had more severe symptoms, I suppose.
Yes.
Yeah.
So to revisit the sort of etiology, so we have the patients who we feel the pain is arising from the subchondral bone.
Yeah.
But also the parapatellar soft tissues can also, if you have patellofemoral malalignment, it's no surprise that you're going to get some tissues that get compressed, some that are stretched, some that are on torsion. And there's a group in Madrid, Sanchez Alfonso's group have been looking at the parapatellar soft tissues and changes that you get in there, and it seems to be that you get similar changes that we see in tendinopathy, so ingrowth of new vessels, and we know when we get that it has associated hyperinnervation, hence can make these tissues pain provoking.
So can I just interrupt you there and can you just clarify for people listening, what do you mean by the parapatellar tissues?
Yeah, so that could be any soft tissues that essentially adjoin the patella, but particularly the medial and lateral retinaculum.
Yeah.
They're the structures I'm particularly looking at. We've also then got Hoffer's infrapatellar fat pad.
Yeah,
so that's the fat pad that sits inferior to the patella. And I think a fair few of my patients that I see have fat pad involvement.
Okay.
The fat pad is actually the most pain sensitive structure in the knee, so they can be very painful and very edematous, so that's another whole subgroup.
Another group of patients. So we've got the subchondral bone people with the subchondral bone pain,
yeah,
parapatellar tissue dysfunction or effects of the parapatellar tissue. And that's really interesting to hear you say that that presents similar to sort of tendinopathies. I would never have thought that could happen. That sort of thing would happen outside of a tendinopathy, but happens in, you know, just things like the retinaculum as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be careful with our phraseology. So it doesn't present clinically the same, but it's in terms of at a cellular level or at a microscopic level, we see similar changes.
Yeah, interesting.
So that's an area for further development. I think we'll see more coming through in the next 5 to 10 years on that whole area.
And how would you recognise that sort of thing in a patient that's in front of you in the clinic?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I think there's a group of patients that come in, when they describe their pain, they use their hand and they sort of create like a stripe down the medial side of their patella. So it's sort of off the patella immediately. And I think often, I mean, this is anecdote, I need to be careful, this is just pulling on my experience rather than there being any paper on this. But I think those patients are often ones who have changes in their medial soft tissues.
And is it more in the medial soft tissues than the lateral?
I think that often they get the symptoms medially. I mean, the research to date shows that the change happens medially and laterally. But I think what happens medially is the medial retinaculum is under sort of chronic low-grade tugging.
Yeah.
And again, I say to our patients, look, if you take your hand and you bend your fingers back, if you did that all day, your hand would hurt. And it's a similar sort of dragging, pulling effects on the medial soft tissues. This, I think, makes them complain. I think often then if we can align things through work on the patella and or the femur, it takes the strain off those soft tissues and then they really can feel a lot better.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So then moving on to the subgroup with the fat pad problems.
Yes. Okay, so the fat pad, as I said, has been shown, Scott Dye's work, shown that it's the most pain-sensitive structure in the knee.
Yeah.
I think they present quite differently. They often have pain in activities in standing or hyperextension.
Yeah.
And most of the patella problems, it's the other way around. It's activities of flexion, such as kneeling, squatting, stair climbing. I think they're very often people who are hypermobile or down that end of the spectrum, have a high Batten score. So they often stand with their knees in hyperextension, or when they move, they flick into hyperextension.
Mm-hmm.
They're often people that like being barefoot at home or in flip-flops, UGG boots, things that are very flat with little support. And you often see they come in and they have really quite an obviously edematous fat pad. And if the pain is from the fat pad, they will be very tender on the fat pad itself.
So you can palpate and
absolutely
reduce their pain.
And as a sort of top tip, I would say that when I run my course, people are always surprised how superior the fat pad goes. It's like a crescent, like a smile under the patella, but either side, it goes right up to the joint line.
Okay.
So it goes, and particularly supralaterally, it often gets impinged at that corner, and that's much higher than people often palpate. So have a good feel, sort of, if you're trying to feel the fat pad, I'd say, you know, come right up to the joint line. And often you can then catch that tenderness, and you're looking obviously as normal to see, is it the patient's pain? Is it familiar to them?
Yeah. And can they have fat pad pain without you being able to palpate and replicate the pain? If you present with fat pad pain.
I think that's unlikely. I think more likely is that they get a bulky fat pad.
Yeah.
The fat pad itself, though, isn't necessarily always painful, but what it does is it disrupts the patellofemoral mechanics because the patella can't descend towards the foot in knee flexion. It sort of, the fat pad gets in the way. So they get patellofemoral pain, but part of the reason why is the bulky fat pad.
Oh, what do you do about that?
Well, you need to ask, why is the fat pad bulky? Why is it edematous? And the patients get often into this really tricky cycle. It's getting nipped by the patella, so it swells up, then because it's swollen it's getting nipped even more.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. I would be looking, so back to your biomechanical assessment really that you would do for the patella femoral joints as well. Try, and then I would also consider offloading the fat pad with tape, doing a taping technique to try and lift the patella off the fat pad to give it a window of opportunity to settle down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. So is that all about the fat pad? Have we covered the fat pad?
Yes, I think that will do without getting too obsessive about it.
Yeah. Okay, so we've got a subgroup. So we've got the subchondral bone pain subgroup, the parapatella changes, people with the parapatella changes, the fat pad people.
Yeah.
Any other subgroups?
No, I mean, I guess we're talking about etiological subgroups,
yeah.
But then you have to be sort of slight devil's advocate and say, well, you know, how much does this change my clinical practice?
Yeah.
How much do I need to worry about, is it fat pad or is it this or that? Now, I personally think the bottom line is to do really good biomechanical assessments, because if you establish their biomechanical problems, you're going to be able to establish what is overloading any one of those three structures. So with my course that I run, that's really the aim of the day, that people at the end are really confident to try and assess those limb mechanics.
Okay, and we're talking about a biomechanical assessment of the whole lower limb, aren't we here?
Yeah, and obviously it can go higher, it can go up, well up into the trunk as well, but being confident to look at why is the patellofemoral joint or the fat pad being overloaded or compressed or impinged, whatever it may be.
Okay, and what are the most common, I don't know if there are, is there a most common presentation of a biomechanical malalignment causing patellofemoral pain?
Well, I guess a lot of the patients have gluteal insufficiency.
Yeah.
So that might be in the frontal planes, that might be in the abductors, which means that during the gaits or during the running cycle, whatever it may be, they get some relative hip adduction, which mm-hmm. creates a valgus moment at the knee, and that in turn overloads the lateral facet of the patella.
Yeah.
Or we might see gluteal problems in the rotational, in the horizontal plane. So then that could be posterior fibers of glute med, or it could be gluteus maximus. And that might be in the gait cycle, it might be as they're ascending the stairs or doing their running, whatever it may be. And obviously in different people it can be more crude or subtle.
Yeah,
but I think a lot of the patients have proximal dynamic stability issues. So that's a big subgroup. We've got the whole ongoing debate about VMO quad.
I was just about to bring up VMO.
Well, it's my it's my other area of research, actually, at the moment. So I guess in a nutshell, the VMO research has been going on forever and a day. And even until the mid-2000s, the debate whether the VMO even exists was still present. So an anatomist at St George's and myself decided to take the bull by the horns. And we did a study which we published in The Knee, where we ultrasounded the VMO of 80 knees. So we did a good size sample, and we were able to demonstrate that it does exist as a separate entity. So there's a fascial plane, there's a different nerve distribution, different fiber orientation. That's not to say we can selectively recruit it, because I don't think we can.
Yeah.
So the research then, the general research domain, has spent a lot of the last sort of 10 years probably looking at firing, looking at VMO firing versus vastus lateralis, looking at delay. And there has been some research to show that you get VMO delay in patients with pain, but the difficulty is it's not in everyone. And we also see it in asymptomatic subjects, which of course always raises the question of relevance. I think it's relevant personally in patients who've had a lot of pain or swelling. So often your post-surgical patients, your post-trauma patients, have gross inhibition of the VMO and hence delay. So in patients that have a history with lots of pain or swelling, that's where I would perhaps be looking at VMO timing, but I think there's a lot of patients where that's irrelevant. So what we did, we came in from a really different perspective, and we've looked at muscle architecture. So we did our first study looking at the basic, describing the anatomy. And then we found that actually, gosh, the anatomy seems to vary a lot within normals.
Mm-hmm.
So we were particularly noticed that the fibre angles, so this is the angle of the VMO relative to the femoral shaft, varied from 30 degrees right round to 70 degrees.
Ooh, that's a big difference.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah.
So what we sort of said, well, what I was saying as a clinician on the study was, well, hang on a minute. Surely someone that has an angle of 70 degrees, that VMO is going to be much better as a medializer than someone at 30 degrees, which is really vertical.
Yeah.
So then we said, well, I wonder whether we can see a pattern with this. So we then did scoring, Tegner scoring. That's just a basic score of activity levels. And sure enough, there was a really neat correlation. So if you're sedentary, you have a small angle. If you are athletic, you have a bigger angle. And we've published that in Clinical Anatomy. So then I said, well, we've got to now find out, can we manipulate this?
That's exactly what I was going to ask you.
I know I'm completely biased, but it has been very exciting. So we then took sedentary people and we put them on an 8-week training program. And sure enough, their VMO all swung round.
Oh, wow. What was the training program out of interest?
So it was a very straightforward mixture of closed and open chain home exercises done alternate days to light fatigue. Nothing fancy.
Specific VMO training or just quads training?
Well, I think the thinking now is you can't selectively VMO train. So, but it would be VMO type exercises like reverse step down, static quads, those sort of things.
Yeah.
So we showed, again, it reached good statistical significance. We showed that the VMO angle swings round. So that's just been published about 3 weeks ago. Again,
excellent.
Clinical Anatomy. So what we've then did was we then said, okay, let's take open chain group versus closed chain group versus a mixed group with a stim, sorry, versus a closed group with a stimulator, muscle stim on,
yeah.
And that was a pilot arm. The closed and the open chain groups had the same positive effects that they managed to, the muscle architecture changed considerably. But interestingly, the group with the stim on did even better. Now, we need to be cautious because that was a pilot arm, it was only six subjects. So that's next year's trial. We're doing a bigger trial with the stim.
So hold on. So the open and the closed chain groups did the same?
Did the same.
And so the only addition is the stim made it better?
Gave a stronger result,
yeah.
Gave more muscle architecture change.
Interesting. And was that the stim on the VMO specifically?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So we've then currently doing a study where we are getting one group to carry on beyond 8 weeks, another group to stop completely, and a third group to do a maintenance program. Because again, I'm always asking what is clinically relevant? And we need to know as physios, when we stop, what happens to our effect?
Mm.
You know, we somewhat make the presumption a lot of the time that their functional movement will carry on and keep the effect, but we don't really know that. So that's, and then I've said, and often we give out sort of, we say to patients, well, just keep doing a little bit. It's almost like a maintenance program. So that's what I want to see, what happens with which of those groups. And that is literally going on at the moment.
Wow. And so my other question is then, is this in asymptomatic people?
It's all in asymptomatics because we felt we wanted to really give a good body of normative data that we had a comparison against. But clearly the direction it's got to then go in is to look at patient population. And obviously we might see different results because the presence of pain, swelling, fear, etc. Mm. I'm also really interested to look at dislocators. There's one study from 20 years ago that showed they had a very proximal VMO. Now it's a bit chicken and egg. Have they evolved when they've dislocated or have they created a very vertical VMO that's very now very proximal. We don't know, but it'd be really interesting to know. And ultimately, what I'd really like to get to the point is that we can predict who are good candidates for quads work, VMO type work, because we've seen very clearly in our work that people with the smallest angle to start with have the biggest change.
Mm-hmm.
So can we use this with the patient population as a predictor of who are good candidates for this kind of work? The problem is with research, you answer questions and you answer them, it throws up more than you've answered.
Yeah. You can see this going on forever and ever and ever.
Yeah, it's very funny because it started off with an email from myself to my anatomy colleague saying, well, I'm doing a talk. Have you got a nice photo of the film? And he said, yeah, I have because I'm really interested in it. And I said, we need to talk.
Yeah.
And it just shows how, you know, and it's been a great collaboration because I can't do it without him with his anatomical knowledge, and he can't do it without my clinical input. So it's one of those examples of collaborative research really working.
That sounds really interesting. So we'll look up that research that you published recently and all your other research that you published, and we'll add it to this post with this audio so that we can relate them both. It'll be good to have a read of that. Anything else on VMO before we move on?
Well, I think it's got a very bad press recently, and I think there are some people that are irritated by the fact that I'm sort of not allowing the VMO argument to sort of go to bed. But and as I'm sort of saying, well, hang on, you know, I'm not saying we can selectively recruit it and we can do exercises that justify the VMO. We're coming in from a very different angle, excuse the pun. Looking at the muscle architecture, which is a completely different paradigm. So there's a long way to go. We've got more questions than we've got answers, and it is early days. We're just looking at asymptomatics, but to me it makes sense. It's interesting.
Yeah, definitely. It totally makes sense. When you think about historically what we've all thought about telefemoral joint pain and things like that. So after VMO, what about the lateral side of the knee? That's got a bad rap in the past as well.
Yeah, so, well, I think one of the bad raps has been from people talking about stretching the ITB, which clearly we can't do. It's a huge, strong structure. But it has contractile proximal origins, namely the TFL and the gluteus maximus, and we can stretch those. So I think that I assess what sort of historically would have been called ITB length, but I'm aware that I'm not looking at the length of the ITB per se. I'm looking at the what I call the complex, the ITB with its contractile origins. And I'm interested in their length, the contractile length, and I'm interested in their levels of activity. I'm also interested in vastus lateralis activity and tone, because I think if that gets very active and tight, it sort of braces out against the ITB, and that causes the appearance that the ITB is tight, but clearly it's not tight.
Oh, okay, yeah, interesting.
And I think people who have poor proximal stability often overuse their quads inappropriately, and I often will get someone to just stand and sway their weight from side to side, which is a very low level task, and so clearly we shouldn't be using our vastus lateralis maximally when we do that. But and if I see that, I'm asking, okay, why are they doing that? Is it that their patellofemoral joint is slightly unstable and they're using that as a coping mechanism to stabilize it? Is it that they're weak proximally and they're compensating for that? So I think that creates problems on the lateral side.
Okay, so more vastus lateralis coming in there than not ITB. So vastus lateralis overactivity and then overactivity as well as TFL and
hypertrophy and tightness.
Yeah. Okay, and is that it on the lateral side?
One other thing about the ITB that people forget, which I think is important, and that's that distally it doesn't just attach onto the patella, it also attaches onto the tibia. And Andrew Amos has done some really elegant studies showing that in knee flexion, particularly around 60 degrees, the ITB complex, if it's tight, I use the word complex, meaning the ITB with its contractile proximal origins.
Yep. Yep.
If that whole complex is tight, it will externally rotate the tibia. And I think you see this sometimes. People will stand with, they'll look fairly neutral, and you put them into step standing, you get them to put their foot on a step, and the foot will swing round, the tibia will swing round into external rotation.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And obviously that alters the load of the patellofemoral joint, and that would immediately be a clue to me to look at that that length of that complex.
And so we're not talking about length on ITB, we're talking about length on glute, max and TFL.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, interesting, interesting. Okay, where do we go from here on patellofemoral joint?
I think perhaps it gives me an opportunity to flag up something that I feel, bear in mind all my patients are second opinions, so they've all pretty much had physio that's failed.
Okay.
So it's quite an interesting perspective on what's going on out in clinical practice. And I think one of the things that I feel really strongly about is that we are not good enough as a profession at exercise prescription.
Mm-hmm.
And I get patients that have been told, they've been given 12 exercises and they've been told to do them 3 times a day times 10 reps. Well, we know if you go above 3 exercises, adherence drops off.
Mm-hmm.
What are we trying to do with 10 reps? Why 10? Why not 9? Why not 12? And I tell, my students, I say, look, you wouldn't expect a GP to give out a drug and just say, oh, do a bit of that, have a bit of You know, we're trying to invoke change with our exercise, so we need to be really accurate with our prescription.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, gluteus medius is a postural muscle, therefore we should be training it for endurance. So therefore our exercise prescription should reflect that. So we should be aiming for high reps, low load to induce our fatigue. And if we're doing a fatigue-inducing exercise, we should only be doing it once, alternate days. Because that's how, we know muscle physiology, that's how muscles respond and get stronger.
Yeah.
So I think that very often I see that amongst many, many exercises that a patient's been given, they've had the correct exercises, but it's been so diluted by the fact they've been given too many exercises. They've lost heart because it's just overwhelming almost to have 8, 10, 12 exercises. To be told you've got to do them 2 or 3 times a day. And I think, oh, it's such a shame, because in amongst that, I can see that there is probably 1 or 2 exercises that really would have hit the nail on the head.
So I suppose this is where the difference comes in from between the recipe that we all... that is often thought about for patellofemoral pain and using clinical reasoning. So if we can have more knowledge about what's going on around the patellofemoral joint and all these subgroups of the different subgroups of pain and things like that, then we can prescribe and do our biomechanical assessment and find out exactly what's going on. Then we can appropriately prescribe less exercises.
Absolutely. And I say at the beginning of my day course, by the end of the day, I want you to be able to put your money on the table and say, right, I'm going to give out no more than 3 exercises and still be effective.
Yeah.
And I'll give you an example of this. For some patients, their prime pain is cinema signs. So pain when they're sat still with their knee flexed.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of say, I hate going to the cinema, getting on a plane, it's awful. That's my biggest problem. So that person is sat still, they're not other than a little bit of weight, they're not using their feet, their muscle firing is irrelevant, muscle strength, force generation is irrelevant. So a lot of the things that classically we would look at for patellofemoral pain should be right down the pecking order. But what should be at the top is doing a really good muscle length assessment.
Mm-hmm,
because these patients don't like being flexed, and then they extend the knee and their pain is gone. So what's the biggest clue there? We should be looking at quads length.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if someone came in and really that was very much their main symptom, I might send them away with purely attacked to address quads length and nothing else. Because if I know they're going to do that twice a day, for a month, they're much more likely to have a good effect than if I've given them 6 exercises and that happens to be one of them. So the clinical reasoning marrying with good exercise prescription, I think, is paramount.
Yeah, I think that's such a great message to come out of this conversation. And, I'm just sitting here thinking, oh, I wish I could have had this conversation when I was a junior clinician, when I just graduated. Because patellofemoral joint, it was always one, for me, it was always very difficult. And definitely, I think you know, it's easy to use that recipe for anterior knee pain, which is what it used to be called, and to know all these different things that, you know, a lot of this is new for me. I don't work clinically now, but to know all these things, it just makes it far less scary. And to know that you just need to do your clinical reasoning, find out exactly what's going on, and just be appropriately prescribing just a couple of exercises, that makes the whole thing seem so much less scary.
Yeah, and also I really believe in getting your patients on board so they really understand why they're, you know, what's going on and why they're doing what you're giving them. And they laugh in the clinic. I cannot do my clinic without the knee model, because I'm with it with every single patient, and I really believe that every single patient leaves my door understanding exactly what's driving the pain and what they're doing for it and why. And I think then they're much more likely to do it. I mean, doing exercises regularly is boring. It yeah. really is. You know, people have busy lives, so you've got to get them on board. And otherwise, you know, it's a waste of everyone's time. So I think, you know, yes, clinical reasoning, exercise prescription, and good communication skills to get that message over to the patient.
I think that's a perfect message for everyone. That's an absolutely perfect message. And again, you know, we've talked a lot about, we've just finished off talking about that in relation to patellofemoral joint pain, but just coming back to the crepitus again, I mean, that's a huge thing, and just using communication skills and getting patients to understand and alleviating their fears, breaking down barriers by alleviating fears is a great way to get them on board and adhering to exercises and
absolutely,
and you know, making a difference to their symptoms and their lives.
Absolutely.
Good. Well, that's been really interesting. Is there anything else on the patellofemoral joint that we need to know about to help all those people out there with patellofemoral joint pain?
I think I guess one final message is that for the vast majority of them, I say to the patients, look, this is a real nuisance, but it's not a worry. You know, mm-hmm. you have a structurally sound knee. Let's try and sort this out, but don't worry about it, because obviously we know the effect of fear and anxiety on pain, and how people handle pain, and then how they alter their behaviour, and how that feeds in back into the whole cycle. And I think there's a real criticism of mine of the field would be that the literature is very heavily skewed to biomechanics mm-hmm. and quantitative data. You know, there's very little qualitative research exploring the phenomenon of patellofemoral pain to patients. But I would say to people looking at the literature and working with these patients, that doesn't mean it's not important. Yes, we need to do the biomechanics, the exercise prescription like we've spoken about, but we also need to explore those pain beliefs with our patients too, like I've spoken about with the crepitus, although that's not pain, but you know, that whole belief, meaning, anxiety, fear thing, I think is very powerful.
And I think that's especially relevant in the patellofemoral joint, because patellofemoral joint pain, people just automatically think, oh, they've got degeneration, or mm-hmm. you know, they've got the degeneration on the back of their patella. And I think people do think that, and they think, well, that's it, that's game over, don't they?
Yeah, I think that's right. So I you know, not being a friend to junior clinicians, perhaps saying it's okay to spend a good amount of your consultation time talking to your patients. Don't feel you have to be doing things to them every minute, you know, that time spent addressing those anxieties, those fears, and those altered belief systems is very valuable, and will actually then mean that you're likely to be more effective with your exercises.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. Getting the patient on board, or a client yeah. on board, yeah. definitely really important. Education, communication and educating our patients. Okay, well, that's been really interesting. I think that's such a great chat through the patellofemoral joint and patellofemoral joint pain. I really hope that people find some of that useful. I know it's been really interesting for me anyway. is there anything else that you wanted to say before we finish
up? I think without going off on too many tangents, that's probably covered the main things, yeah.
Yeah, great. I think it's been a really nice, succinct roundup of the patellofemoral joint. So thank you very much, Claire, for being with us today. It's been
pleasure.
Lovely to chat to you.
People.
Thank you.